Good evening, everybody. We're about to get started. So glad to have you all here tonight. My name's Judy. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. For everybody that would care to join us, we're going to open the meeting with a moment of silence, and then we're going to say the Serenity Prayer together, okay? God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, and those are located across the main foyer and up that small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving about the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen undisturbed or uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a primary purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I'm now going to read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open, big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step being discussed tonight. And this evening, we are on the second part of step four. And I'm going to turn the meeting over to Ashley, and we're going to start on page 67. And I will, the fourth step is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And Ashley, I want to read.
All right. So the first paragraph we're reading is from page 67, and it begins, "Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble." Now, would you want me to share on it?
Sure.
Okay. All right. I would say for me, the fourth step is probably my favorite and least favorite step ever of the 12. With this step, I feel like I went through it one time before where I did it really halfway, and I essentially just kind of went through the motions, and I told myself that there were things that I wasn't going to put on the fourth step, I wasn't going to share with my sponsor, but I was like, well, I'll just sort of get through it. And that, just like they talk about in the book, half measures availed us nothing. I didn't get any relief. I didn't feel any better. I was sober, not drinking, but I was just walking around still with all the same crap inside of me. And when I heard enough, I went back and sort of, with that willingness, I went through again. And I did it out of, just like they describe in the instructions as far as exactly how to do it. And I laid out my columns, and I put down my resentments, and I went through the through the fourth step as the inventory as they suggest, and I had I don't know that I went through in my inventory and I found the word fear, but my sponsor pointed out that out to me, that that was really the basis of what was going on in each situation. And for me, it was a lot of fear, and I still have this, but fear, what are people going to think of me? How are people going to judge me? Which kept me from doing my first fourth step thoroughly the first time. And in this paragraph where it says, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling, the fourth step for me really opened up. It stopped the whole victim mentality. You know, I couldn't blame everybody else anymore. I had to really see my part in things. And I couldn't just, point the finger anymore. I was just looking to see if there was anything else. But I definitely felt like I didn't deserve things. And that was, I think, probably the most humbling thing that came out of my fourth step, was to really say, like, this is who I am. You know, that sadly, you know, this selfish, dishonest, self-centered, full of fear, that even if I had heard that in a meeting, even if I had said that about myself in other meetings, oh, yeah, I'm selfish and self-centered to the extreme, just like they say in the book, I had said that, but I don't think I really believed it till I saw these things laid out, and I sort of saw how my selfish motives really were affecting my whole life and all my relationships. So,
thank you. So, fear is bracketed alongside all the difficulties. And last week when we were here, David talked about the format of the four step and the columns and writing the stuff down. And of course, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that would be unnecessary for me because I didn't need to write anything down because I had everything in my head, and I was what I didn't understand was that the problem was between my ears. And what I needed to do was put it down on paper. It's a whole different experience. And they kept saying to me, this is about an experience you're going to have. It's not about something that you seemingly don't know, because you do know the answer to all of these questions. What's going to happen to you is that you're going to give up your resistance, which was a huge deal for me. Resistance, that was the way I lived. I made a practice of being resistant to anything. If you said one way, I'd just do the other way. You know, I'm an arguer and a debater. And, my sponsor told me that the thing about resign from the debating society was specifically for me, because I was big on that, you know. I'd want to argue a point in a big book. And she finally said to me, the point of this is that you either take all of this and swallow it or you don't. We don't have an in-between thing, and we don't get to debate it. Debating is what got you in the seat. So let's just accept and agree and move forward. So I won't say how many years it took me to do that. Anyway, this fear thing, when I came to AA, I didn't know I was afraid because I had covered it up for so long, I couldn't identify it anymore. But I was terrified. All the time, afraid of my own shadow. The only thing that made me settle down was drinking. Drinking was required for me. I couldn't function without it. And I grabbed onto it early in my life. At 13 was the first time I drank, and held on until it almost killed me because of this terrible, terrible fear. So it was a little hard for me to inventory or to see that I am afraid when I couldn't connect to that at all. I'm not afraid. This is why I was such a debater and an arguer, because that kept me distanced from that fear. If I could debate something with you and put you in your place, then I could protect myself from you, because I thought that was my job, because you're out to get me. And so the fear, just recently I did a fourth step and a fifth step, and I'm working on the amends that connected to that, and I just got this great revelation from my current sponsor about it, and she said that self-reliance is everything that you do or don't do to make sure that a fear doesn't become a reality. And I was completely just blown away by that. I had never heard anybody put that into those words before, and it absolutely put into place all my experience, sober and drunk. And I have set my sights unknowingly many times on trying to protect myself from a fear that I have. So there's a whole string of them. I'll just tell you a couple of them. I married the man I married because I was afraid of being alone. That's not why you get married. And when we split up, I found out that's what he did. So we were in agreement on that one thing. And, you know, I was just telling somebody today. Today I was at work and somebody said something that hurt my feelings. And I walked out of the meeting and thought, I don't belong here, I don't fit here, you know, all the stuff that we do. I'm not right, I need to go, you know, I have to quit my job, on and on. And on another day, I might not have even have caught it, what she said. And it was just something that she said that made me feel old and out of place. And, you know, I work with everybody I work with, I could be their mother, okay? So every day I go to work, I have to face this fear I have of getting old. And God's put me in a place where I get to face that on a daily basis. I really think this is his, you know, it's definitely his doing. I have to confront this every day. And, you know, the reason is because if I get too self-involved in being afraid of getting old, I will be so consumed by that I won't be able to act right. You know, I won't be able to see you. I won't be able to listen to you. I won't be able to help anybody. I'll just be consumed with, you're old. So I get to face this on a daily basis and not let it consume me or take me down. And the only way that I can do that is to have this inventory process. And I said to somebody this week, I've had just a very interesting, challenging couple of weeks. And after a couple of days, I had a good resolution to something. And then 2 days after that, I was just, you know, like deer in the headlights again. So I sat down. I did exactly what they tell us to do in the book. I sat down and I wrote down all of my fears, all of the things I'm anxious about. 3 pages. I looked down and I said, God, it's only been 2 days. There's 3 pages. I'm hopeless. So the good thing about that is that I tell you that story because I've been sober quite a while. And I want you to understand that this is a one day at a time. You got to show up and grow up and write the stuff down and show up on the phone and talk to the sponsor and move along, because if I don't, the alcoholism will get me. I have alcoholism. It has nothing to do with drinking. I don't drink anymore, I haven't drank in a long time. But I have this capacity, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, to just take myself right out of the game. And it's all based on fear. Every character defect I have is driven by fear. Real, fancied, it doesn't matter. The answer's the same. I still have to inventory it. So what does that make me do? Well, in, you know, 15 years ago, if I'd been in that meeting today, I may have taken this girl's face off after what she said to me. But I didn't. You know, I just quietly took this in and got up and departed from the meeting like a normal human being. Now, when I do that, am I a normal human being? I think not. I'm still alcoholic. And the fact that I can admit that every day in my walk is the thing that absolutely saves my life. And then I have a solution, and that's what we're talking about tonight. And fear will make me do things that will turn my, you know, it's all upside down. I think I'm protecting myself, and the reality is if I act based on fear, I'm leaving myself completely open to be taken over by the thing I'm most afraid of. You know, if I'm afraid of losing my job, I will lose my job if I take a couple people's face off. That's gonna happen to me. you know? And intellectually knowing that is useless. It really doesn't help me to know that. What helps me is to know what to do when this happens. Fear, go home and write about it. Call the sponsor, go to the AA meeting. All these, the simple actions that we're taught to do so that we are not held captive by resentment, anger, fear, all the character defects. Okay, I'll read on. And then. Okay, we're on page 68 now. Perhaps there's a better way. Okay, so we just talked about fear. It sets in motion all these things that ought to be classed with stealing. And now the book says, perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. I think I kind of addressed that, so okay. On you go.
Okay, it's interesting. I actually was asked to speak at another meeting, and as Bill sees it, and the reading I chose was this exact excerpt. So it's been something that's been on my mind for the last, little while here, and especially that line, just to the extent that as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? I've had a lot of changes in my life go on in the last year, and one of my friends was just mentioning to me before the meeting, oh, so you're married, and you got a stepdaughter, and you're doing this, and you're doing that, and I've moved from Norfolk to Virginia Beach, and my nature is to manage and control, just like I tried to do with my drinking, and that didn't work, and it doesn't work with my life, and it didn't work with drinking, and the solution for me has been finding a higher power through working these steps, and then, to the extent that I can, relying on him, trusting in him, turning my life and my will over to him again and again and again. And I thought, and I know this plays a little into step three, I thought that it was going to be a one-time deal, okay, I'm done, that's finished, I've turned my will and my life over to God. And then I'd hear people say, oh, no, you have to do it continually. And I thought, oh, okay, so it'll happen like several times throughout my life, maybe as big changes come about, change a job, get married, hopefully not, maybe get divorced, again, hopefully not. But, things like this, have kids, whatever, that, okay, I'll have to like regroup and ask God for help again. And what I have found in the time I've been in AA is that it's sometimes a daily thing and multiple times a day and multiple instances throughout times of the day, because my instinct is still to rely on myself, and I think when I'm relying on myself, that is where the fear comes in, because of myself I'm inadequate, I need my higher power and I need you guys in these rooms. And sorry if I'm jumping around too much, but talking here a little bit about all men of faith have courage, they trust their God, we never apologize for God. I used to think when I was growing up, the whole God concept, people that I equated people who believed in God as people who were religious, and that's obviously not the case. And I thought that religious people, God believers, were dorks and just nerds, and I didn't want to hang out with them. They weren't the cool kids. They weren't the people partying and doing the stuff I wanted to do. So I'd try to disassociate myself from them. And then when I started to get this, and even pre-AA, I started to get a little spirituality and got some God in my life through different venues. I did apologize for God. I would kind of keep it a secret. I didn't want to tell people what I believed because I thought they would think I'm a dork and I'm a nerd and, and I'm not cool, and because I cared so much about what people thought of me. And now I remember one of the first times, and it was really cool to be able to share this with somebody who was having the same experience, and I said, this is what I did. Why don't you try this? But I was at work one time, and I used to be like a raving lunatic, and I know you probably can't imagine that. But people were like, even now, are a little scared of me, and I'm like, I haven't acted that way in years. But but they think, and not scared, but they're worried about my reaction. They think I'm gonna freak out. They're, you know, they think they need to walk on, you know, eggshells around me. And sadly, again, through fourth step stuff, I could really see myself. And I was like that, and it wasn't always, you know, screaming, running around literally like a lunatic, but I would be jerky and be a bitch and storm off to my office and make catty remarks and just was overall unpleasant to work with, unpleasant to deal with. Some people say, you know, I did not work and play well with others, and that was definitely the case for me. And so, yeah, so finally somebody noticed the change in me, the spiritual awakening, the, you know, what happens through these steps, my, what do they call it, the
reorganization,
reorganization, but basically like they noticed that I had really changed from this, and part of me just, I wanted to lie because that's what I do and I wanted to say, oh yeah, I mean, just, you know, I don't know, just maybe it's just running, or things are going good at work, or, you know, I'm in this new relationship. You know, I just wanted to make up something else. And I knew that was a lie. And so I told them the truth. I said, and I didn't say I'm in AA and I'm working the steps and I have a sponsor and I'm actually doing what I'm supposed to do. But I said, I'm really trying to live a spiritual life and I'm connecting with God and I'm, you know, trying to just live differently and do things differently. And the person's like eyes got really wide, but interested, you know, excited kind of way. And they asked me a few more questions. And they came to me a couple of different times and, you know, asked me different stuff. And it was amazing. And I had, like I said, when the friend of mine said, I'm always happy at work. I'm in a good mood. And everybody where I work, everybody's all grouchy all the time and stern face. And people keep asking me, you know, Tammy, why are you so happy all the time? And she said, I don't know what to tell them. And I was like, why don't you tell them the truth? Why don't you tell them that it's God, you know, that it's your new connection with your higher power, your relationship with him or whatever you want to say, but along those lines, why don't you say something like that? And she said she started telling people that, and some people were freaked out and some people were super interested, and it just kind of opened up some new relationships for her and for me too. It's been that way, and it's nice to not lie. It's nice to just be honest and keep the story straight. You know, that if I had said to this girl, oh, well, it's because this is off my plate or it's because of this new relationship, I would have had to remember, what did I tell her and did I tell her the same thing? Now I just tell the truth and it's a lot simpler. I was going to see if there was anything else I wanted to share on this. And just this thing, instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. It, for me, that reminds me a lot about what we talk about being a living example of the big book, that we don't have to preach AA. There's people in my life and my family that need this program, you know, and we, in my humble opinion, but all I can do is, you know, lay out for them what happened to me and the change that's happened in my life. And beyond that, if I've said it one time, it's done. They have the information. But now I have to demonstrate what God can do in my life. And I have to act the program and show them that. And so that's what I try to do to people around me. And hopefully I'm an attraction to AA and not, you know, making people run away screaming. So
thanks, Ashley. Okay, so we are now continuing on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but after all, we tried to be sensible on this question. But above all, sorry, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. It's absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Okay, so now we come to the seemingly unspeakable aspect of this inventory deal. And, you know, we're asked to inventory ourselves based on our resentments, our fears, and our sex conduct. And in the beginning, I was not interested in the fear and the sex inventory at all, because it was enough for me, enough for me to do the resentments. So I excused myself from that part. But what it taught me is that why we're asked to look at those areas of our life is because it's so evident. I couldn't rationalize it. I couldn't justify it in any way. In that area of life, selfishness displays itself like fireworks going off. I mean, selfishness is really clear about, it's very clear. There's no arguing about it. You're clearly selfish. You're clearly not in this for anything but yourself. And when you're in a relationship like that, at whatever level of relationship, and it's really about relationships. That's what we're trying to, the book is asking us to look at, relationships, because this whole thing, you know, bad news as it is about relationships. A relationship with God, a relationship with myself, a relationship with other people. And when I came, my alcoholism was about no relationship with you, numb myself so I can't feel anything, and forget God. So there were no relationships in my life. I didn't know how to have them, and I didn't want them, okay? So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely detested this place. I am not one of those people that came here and thought, I'm home and you're my family. I was like, I've sunk to the bottom now, is what I was thinking. And I don't want your phone number. Don't touch me and stop hugging me. Okay, I'm just leave me alone. And don't look at me too long because you make me nervous. And I still can't sit with anybody on my back. I can't sit with my back to the door. I'm just funny that way. So I am. So so I'm, zero failure in the relationship department. Well, however, I came to in a marriage, and I came to in a marriage with a child, and the relationships are required here. And so the point of having a sex inventory is not so that you can talk about your sexual exploits. That's not really what you're trying to do. And everybody gets all nervous about it and laughs and is jittery about it. But the real reason that we look at this is because it's clear, crystal clear, who we are in that arena. There's no doubt that you're an inability to form a true partnership with another human being. And that is our problem. And when we can't do that, we can't form a relationship with God. And if we can't form a relationship with other people or with God, we're really just dead in the water. We really are not useful to other people or to God or to ourselves. Which makes drinking necessary, by the way. In that state, in order for me to continue moving through life and breathing and working and doing all the things that human beings do, I've got to be numbed out. I've got to be drunk because I can't stand the pain of being in a relationship. It's painful. It's painful because I'm not getting my way. It's painful because I don't get to direct the show. These are the reasons I can't be in a relationship. So that kind of pain, there's only one solution for it, alcohol. So this is quite a fix you're in when you come in here and think, I got to stop drinking. So what do I do with all of that? You get it down on paper and you tell the truth about it. So that's why we're here. And it really does work because, here's a good laugh for you. I am an introvert. I don't like people, and my business is all about people. That's what I do for a living. I have to be with people all day long. I got to talk to them all the time. I have to resolve their problems.
to do all these things I am not equipped to do. Don't even want to do it, really. If you gave me a choice, you know, if you said you can sit in this room by yourself and do this little tasky thing and we'll pay you, I'd be like, sign me up. So, and honestly, I know, you know, it's always hard when you haven't seen somebody from the beginning, but there are a few people in here who've seen me from the beginning, and I don't have what I need to do what I do today, which tells me that absolutely God has worked a miracle in my life and transformed me and rearranged me from the inside as a result of doing this, because I couldn't get up and walk out my door every morning if he hadn't done that. I would be drunk, because this is very hard being out here when you have no defense. No defense against the first drink, no defense against you, no way to not be absolutely taken down by all my perceptions and what I think, and when I think about what I think you're thinking about, and on and on and on. So inventory is the solution to start to get a handle on that. It's not the entire solution, so that the idea is not to do this and then stop, which I did that too, so I know that doesn't work. This is just the beginning, because even in the book, it's after the fifth step, it says, now you're beginning to have a relationship with God and the people about you. That's at the end of the fifth step. And then, of course, at the end of the ninth step, you've repaired a lot of damage, so I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, ma'am.
Okay. This sex inventory, I was really afraid about, a little like Judy mentioned, because I thought I was going to have to go into nitty-gritty detail of every sexual exploit I had ever had, and just the horrible things that I had done and people I'd been with and things like that. But when I finally got down to doing the business of the steps, I was really willing, and I was going to do whatever anybody told me to do. And when I read in the book, it just said, I don't know the exact words, but maybe that's our next paragraph, but basically it was to examine these relationships and each of them and see, was it selfish or not, and, you know, kind of look at me in that relationship. And I think those relationships, and like Judy said, it's how can I relate to other people, but I think maybe more than any other resentment and relationship that came out of the first columns of my fourth step, the sex inventory really brought forward clearly for me my character defects, and they were just really blaring to me, because for some reason, maybe because some of the relationships were far enough back for me that I could see them a little more clearly, it's the ones that I was currently in, or not ones, well, yeah, maybe some ones that I was currently in or very recently had been in, it wasn't as easy to see. But some of them, I mean, it was like, go back to what I was told is go back to any, you know, sexual relationship that you had, and seemingly so any sort of intimate, you know, relationship that if it was sexual is presumably fairly intimate. And so, yeah, I think when I went through those, the big thing for me that came out of it, like I said, was my character defects, my selfishness, my dishonesty, and not just dishonest with other people, but dishonest with myself about what the relationship really was, because I would like to wrap things up like, this is a nice relationship, this is sort of how it should be, this is a boyfriend-girlfriend thing, or, you know, whatever. And meanwhile, when I really looked at different things, it was just me not wanting to be alone. It's kind of me. I remember when my sponsor pointed out to me, she's like, you're using him. Do you see that? You use this person, you use that person. And this, my sponsor is loving and sweet and kind and just the nicest person and soft-spoken. And she didn't say it to me mean or pointing her finger, but it felt that way a little bit. But I needed her to be honest with me and tell me what was really going on and help me see that. And I could see it. And I remember finally when, not that first time, but another time when she broke it down for me that way. And just remember being on my phone with her in the car and just pulling to the side and just crying, I know I am. I don't want to be that way anymore. But I didn't realize how dependent I was on these people, these men, these relationships. And a lot of my worth came from being in a relationship. It was all, I mean, it maybe sounds a little psychobabble, but it was a lot about growing up and being an adult and being mature that I learned, you know, through this inventory process. And this is something from the 12 and 12, but where it talks about that unhealthy dependence on people, that I really had that a lot. You know, as I was younger, maybe I was using people more because it was cool to have a boyfriend or I wanted to have people to hang out with. But then it did get more like, you know, because this person could afford to go on trips with me, or because this person was really knowledgeable and could help me, like, decide what I need to do about buying a car or buying a house or, you know, whatever. It was just, I needed to grow up and make decisions myself, make my, you know, be my own person. And, it made me feel really, I always thought that I was the victim. I was the one that had been wronged, and I could see that definitely wasn't the case. And even in cases where I had been harmed, it was very equal. It wasn't, you know, me just poor Ashley, which is that whole, you know, people say, you know, pour me another drink. And yeah, there were reasons that to kind of cope with these unhealthy relationships, part of my coping mechanism was drinking. And this is me. I don't know if this is on task for this, but it is about sex. I will say that this is a little personal, but I'm just going to throw it out there. Two things that I thought I would never be able to do or be able to do in a very fun way if I wasn't drinking was sex and dancing. And I will tell you that there is healthy, good sex outside of drinking. So, and dancing too. I can sober dance now as well. It did take a little while to get used to that. But that was my thing, like, and they talk about that, whether it be in the Big Book or 12 and 12, but that, you know, alcohol makes us sexually charged and we do run into problems with sex relations. And so it's a big part of a lot of people's story, and definitely was the case for me. So.
Okay. All right. And we're moving on to page 69 in the book. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Wow. So that's a tall order. First of all, I have to create some... mold some sane idea of what my future is supposed to be like. And how I did that was pretty simple. One of my early sponsors said to me, it doesn't matter what your life constitutes, if you want a different life, if you drag the old life into the new life, you'll soon have the old life. So what you want to do is recreate a life that doesn't look like the old life. You don't want to do what you did in the old life. You don't want to have to practice or to think about things in the same way. So I had to ask God for that because, again, I don't have the ability to do that. I can't come up with that. I can, you know, earlier in the book it talks about philosophical convictions. I had a million of those. I couldn't live up to them, just the way it says in the book. So what that tells me is I don't have the power to come up with this. So I have to ask God for that. And we also went through a process of, you know, write down how you would envision a healthy relationship, write that down. And that was a nice exercise, but that's not a solution, but it's a nice exercise. It at least gets me thinking about what's possible, what would be something to reach for. But the bottom line is, it doesn't really matter what I think. What most matters is asking God to mold the ideal. You mold it, not me. So that may mean, and does mean, and has meant,
that I have had to say no to some things I might have said yes to before. And I've had to, which this whole thing is really, sobriety is about that. I've had my early sponsors used to say to me, you can't, you know, and I'd be in a mess. What's the matter? What's the matter? How did I get here? You can't say no. You cannot say no to yourself. That's the problem. It doesn't have anything to do with them. You can't say no to you. And this has been an ongoing thing and continues to be. You know, this is something that I have to do on a daily basis. Can I say no to myself? Can I give up? Can I say to God, you take the reins? You be God, God, instead of me being God. And that's really what this is talking about. Can I really, with a sincere heart, ask God to mold my ideal, even though I don't know what it is, and I, if you could tell me about it before I'm asking for it, maybe I wouldn't agree with it. But the key to this is that when I ask God to mold my ideal about anything, about my perspective at work, about a relationship, about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm asking for is for him to rearrange my insides. Change my heart is another way to say it, in a way that will be worthwhile and useful to God, not particularly to me and to my selfish desires, because my desires are by heart and nature selfish. So anything I can come up, I just start from this proposition, that anything I'm going to come up with is going to be selfish and self-centered at the heart of it. It just is. I don't have a hope of that. So I have to have God. This makes God a requirement. God is not optional. I have to have a God of my understanding, because left to my own devices, I will always go back to my old self and my old life. So I have got to be constantly reaching for God to change me and rearrange me on the inside, which is the definition of a spiritual experience. And it's an ongoing thing. It's not something, as Ashley was just saying, that happens and you're done with it. It's ongoing. And I have to wake up in the morning and participate in it every day and not say, I'm taking the next 2 weeks off. Thanks very much. So, and that's a challenge some days. So, this is a moment of truth, and it's between you and God. And nobody knows the truth of what happens in that relationship. Not your sponsor, not your best buddy in AA. The real truth of that is between you and God. And the demonstration of what happens in that relationship will be revealed in your life. And I don't mean by you get the car and the girl and the bank account. I don't mean that. The demonstration in your life is the level of calm in a storm, ability to be at peace when everything around you, just the way it's described in our literature, be at peace when everything around you is coming apart. You know, you grasp onto something that's so different than you ever knew before, that you're, not only do you not drink, but you have an ability to walk through anything and share that with somebody else and help them do the same thing, which is, I mean, what else do you want? Do you really want something else other than that? I have to ask myself that question when I get a little arrogant. You know, I don't have enough money, I don't have the right car, whatever I'm stressing about or going on about in my head. And then I have to come back to the reality, which is, look at what you've been given. Oh my God, you've been saved from an alcoholic death. You have something that's worthwhile to share with somebody else. And you have people that love you. What do you want? And, you know, that's the question. I always want more of whatever it happens to be, and most of the time I can't tell you what that is that I want more of. Just more, please. Okay, so moment of truth, me and God, and it has to happen every day. And I'm always having to look at, I have to keep asking him, you know, make me who you intend me to be in my job, help me to strive for whatever it is you intend me to strive for, because I'm striving for what? Recognition, more money, a different position, a promotion. And if I got everything I wanted, I'd probably be drunk, because it wouldn't be enough, because I'd be all focused in on that, and I wouldn't be focused in on where that the strength and the power for that to happen it comes from. And that's the key for a spiritual foundation. I have to be focused on where is this coming from? It's not coming from inside of me. And I'm lying to myself on a daily basis if I tell myself that at any moment. And I do lie. You know, by nature, I lie. So I will lie to myself about that. But then I have to come back to this moment of truth. Me and God, what's the truth? The truth is, you didn't get yourself here. You didn't get yourself sober. You showed up in a crap of a mess. And God picked me up out of the doorway and put me back on my feet. He did it through Alcoholics Anonymous, the people who have sponsored me, the friends that I've had, these women who have just reached into my soul and pulled me up out of a pit, reached in and pulled me up, because there's no getting up out of that pit by yourself. There's just none. They had to reach in and pull me out. And because I kept picking up the phone and they kept picking up the phone, and I didn't walk away. That's the only thing I did right.
Okay. So are we?
Going to read the next paragraph?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. This is also on page 69. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I don't think I have a lot to share about this. I know we're getting close to the end, but I was going to say that a little bit about inviting God into these relationships. I remember my relationships were always sort of self-will, what I wanted, what was good for me. You know, I mentioned to you about using people unknowingly. But I was trying to do something different. And I think out of my inventory, the biggest thing that came was sort of when it says, you know, where are we selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who do we hurt? We got this all on paper. What could we have done instead? What should we have done instead? And my thing was always, I should have been honest. Because all the problems were always created by being dishonest about how I feel, being dishonest about what I was doing, who I was with, where I was, but especially about how I feel. And so a couple things, practical things I started to do was, if I was dating someone, one, I didn't have sex with them till I was serious about being in a relationship with them, which was new for me. And that required making different choices, going different places, you know, just doing different stuff. And then two, and this was really weird. I don't think my sponsor suggested this. She did say invite God on your date with you. And so what I did was I prayed before dates, that I got on my knees. You know, I'd always pray in the morning on my knees in the morning and at night. But before somebody got ready to pick me up for a date, I would get on my knees and just say, God, be with me during this date. Help me to be honest. Help me to be true to who I am. You know, just direct me in my actions as you would have me do. You know, something along those lines. And it was really amazing kind of how those particular relationships, I mean, progressed, you know. And I did that more, I feel like, you know, in ones that I was nervous, first, second, third, fifth date kind of things. And there were times, I remember breaking up with someone, and I never broke up. I just sort of let the relationships fizzle and die, and they just went away eventually. But I remember, like, being so nervous about talking to somebody, and I just got this weird sort of creepy feeling from this guy, and I wanted to shove it away because on paper he looked great and he was good looking and athletic and all this stuff, nice job, but just something wasn't right about it. And I ended up calling him and just telling him that, essentially, you know. And but before I did it, I knew I was going to be dishonest, I knew I was just going to flake out. And I prayed before I made the phone call, and I got off the phone and I was like crying. And one, I was sad because I don't have what I want, I'm gonna be alone, I'm never gonna be with anybody nice. But two, I was also crying that, like, God had changed me so much that I would be willing to do that. Like, so it was sadness, but it was also joy. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror as I'm trying to stop crying and just, like, laughing and crying, because it was such sort of a miracle that I would do something like that. I mean, that's not who I was. And once I did it one time, then it was so much easier to just say stuff, you know, that it was all in my head, this, all these fears and worries, and they really weren't reality, you know. And it just helped create, it's helping to create, you know, who I am now, and a person with a lot more character and integrity than I had before. I acted as if I had character and integrity before, and many, many people in my life thought that I did. And in some cases, I did truly act that way, but a lot of it was a facade. I mean, a lot of it was because I kept a lot of stuff secret, and I only let people see sort of that stage character. I let people see who I wanted them to see, but not the real me, not what was really going on. Do you want me to read this last little paragraph? Okay. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Do you mind if I say something before
go.
I turn over to you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I only have one thing to share on this, and I'll let Judy talk, but this first part of the paragraph where it talks about if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. I use that, and I share that with my sponsees about anything. If work is very troublesome, if your marriage is very troublesome, if your eating disorder is very troublesome, I mean, whatever, if you're struggling with sobriety, you know, whatever is very troublesome in your life, I feel like the answer for us, maybe as alcoholics, is to throw ourselves the harder into helping other people. Think of other people's needs and work for them, because just like it says, it takes us out of ourselves. Because I get so self-obsessed with all the stuff I mentioned, job and relationships and husband and family and, you know, practicing addicts in my life, that I just, it's very troublesome, and I'm not relying on my higher power. And I think to get out of that, what works not only with sex, with any troublesome problem in my life, is to throw myself the harder into helping other people. So, sure. Yeah.
And this is, while we might do this initially just because somebody says do it, the magic that happens is ultimately, you know, like I was saying before, your heart gets changed, and then you really do want to do it, and you really are interested, even in people you don't particularly like all that much, which amazes me, you know? Because you don't have to like somebody to save their life. And, you know, you might not like them like some of the time, and you might really love them another part of the time, and, you know, that's all okay. You don't have to be one extreme or the other. You just have to be willing. And what it does is, like in the beginning, it maybe takes you, kind of distracts you. But as I worked the steps and continued to come, it became less of something that distracted me or just gave me something to do, and more of a way to what happens is I meet God. I don't have direct communication with God. I meet God through the people that I am associated with in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether they're my friend or I'm sponsoring them or they're sponsoring me. That's where I meet God. That's where I know there is a God. And nothing will make you believe in God more than sitting in an AA room consistently over time and watching people get sober. Because when you see somebody come in and you see the condition they're in when they come in, and then you see them a year later and 2 years later and 3 years later, and like Ashley is talking about, and see their lives come all back together or together maybe for the first time, there's no denying that. You've watched that process happen with your own eyes, and you can't say there's no God. You just can't say it. You can't say it and live with yourself. You can't say that and not be living a double life. And all of this is about changing and rearranging from the inside out, and taking that person that lives in between your ears and the one that you're playing, pretending to be out here, and turning that into one human being that's happily and usefully whole. And that's absolutely a promise, and there's no, that's the promise. So if you want the promise to come true,
then you do what it says in the book. Do what we do, and you get what we get. Okay, I think we can end on that note, unless you'd like to add anything.
No.
Thanks for being here tonight, Ashley. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we are going to pass the seventh tradition basket tonight to support every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While the contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Anybody have any announcements tonight for the good of Alcoholics Anonymous? Sir?
Wild Alcoholic.
Hey, Wild.
1153 Harmony Road, which is the Easy Desert Center, has late night meetings at 10:30 p.m. every night except for Saturday. And they could use some support, so if you're up that late at night and you need to hit a meeting, I'm going to be there Mondays and sometimes on Tuesdays. So if you want any more information, just talk to me.
Okay. Did everybody hear that? Easy Does It, 10:30 every night, Sunday through Friday. Sir.
Hi, I'm John McCulloch.
Hi, John.
Please mark your calendars. Saturday, June the 22nd, will be the annual Gratitude in Action event, previously known as Saturday on the James. It'll be at Ghent United Methodist Church from 9:30 until about 3. We're going to have a series of workshops, free food. It'll be a cookout. It is free to attend. We'll also be having a speaker. So please mark your calendars. And if you want, I am selling raffle tickets, the funding of which goes towards that event. But the raffle tickets are $1, and we will have a drawing. And whoever wins the raffle will have a weekend for two at the Oceanfront Conference. So please see me after the meeting if you'd like to buy a raffle ticket. And Gratitude in Action is Saturday, June 22nd.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, John. Yes, ma'am. Okay.
And if you're hard of hearing, that's game night.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. I know. Now we're going to have a Q&A on the announcements. Wait a minute. Did you say? Okay. Any other announcements? Do we have any other announcements? Okay, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety would just like to welcome you, anybody? Yes, ma'am. Hey, Arrington, welcome. We have a hand over here.
My name's
Margaret,
I'm an alcoholic addict.
Hey, Margaret, welcome. Hey, Thomas, welcome. Mark, welcome. Yes, sir.
My name's Adrian, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Adrian.
Welcome, welcome. Okay, home group members, raise your hand again. New people, these are the people that you want to see if you need a sponsor, or you just want to ask a question, or you think you might not come back. We want you to come back. Okay, we do have literature somewhere right here on the table with meeting lists, and sponsorships in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. We'll just do that again. Okay, thank you to everybody who participated again. Ashley, we were so pleased that she came to be with us tonight. After we clean up, we're invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, which... is to be determined.
We're thinking Plaza del Sol. Is that what we said? 22nd and Colonial.
22nd and Colonial, Plaza del Sol, our old haunt. Bella has closed its doors, so we can't go there. But anyway, Plaza del Sol, 22nd and Colonial. Okay. All right. And the last two paragraphs on page 164, John has volunteered to do that.
I am John, still an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God and as you understand God, admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past, give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge that road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen. So we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer. Anybody wants to join us?
That's awesome. Nobody knows that.
No.
Nobody.
I'm still thinking that was
like,
what's that?
He sneezed and he was like, may God bless you. That's awesome.
Thanks again for coming out. If you're new here, please stop and talk with us. We want to speak with you and welcome you to the fellowship. Robert, will you take us out?